This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Welcome, everybody, to the first of the National Museum's platform conversations. I just got a little bit of housekeeping to do before we begin, and that's to advise you that the event is being photographed and recorded for museum-related web spaces, and that the program will be broadcast on Sky TV's Australian Public Affairs channel at a later date. And also to advise you that during the question and answer session at the end of the program, by participating, you are providing consent to be recorded for that broadcast. And also, just to remind you before we begin, to please turn off your mobile phones. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet and pay my respects to the elders and to acknowledge Agnes O'Shea. The past is not dead, it's not even past. That line from William Faulkner that's been quoted and paraphrased many times since it was written by thinkers as diverse as Hannah Arendt, Barack Obama and Sir William Dean could be a motto for the National Museum of Australia. And it expresses the idea behind platform conversations. When I took up the position as director of the National Museum a little over a year ago, I said that the National Museum should be political. Political, but not politicised. Certainly, we deal with the past, as every museum must, but we also concern ourselves with contemporary Australia. If we engage with those ideas and feelings and subjects that are pervasive in contemporary society, then we are necessarily political. The choices we make in our exhibition programs and in our public programs, the objects we focus on in our collecting, and the subjects we treat in our publications, these are all part of contemporary discourse. These choices are necessarily informed by the things that we believe are important for the future. In a museum, discussions about the future are as important as insights into the past. Museums are educational resources for society, and they are perhaps most importantly social institutions that have an important role in examining the ideas that inform our society. No idea is without a history. It's the fundamental and important educational mission of the museum to connect those ideas that we live by with their history. And it's important for us to examine the ways in which previous generations of Australians have formed ideas, what they saw as the essential and vital issues, and how they framed policy to deal with them. This is the philosophy behind platform conversations. Now, in its early years, the National Museum of Australia was not afraid to court controversy. Indeed, the early history of this institution is a history of engagement in what was then called the Culture Wars. The intensity with which some of the arguments were carried on is no longer a characteristic of the environment in which the museum finds itself. And perhaps the museum has indeed played a part in creating a different set of perspectives on Australian history, and in particular, more nuanced understandings of Indigenous histories and cultures. This, after all, is one of the legislated mandates of the National Museum. The idea of platform conversations is to bring debates around contemporary issues into the museum. Some of the early history of the museum was surrounded by a certain amount of acrimony in the tone of argumentation, and I hope it's characteristic of a more mature environment that we should be able to examine a great range of topics, bringing into the discussion some broader historical perspectives and to understand the complexities of some of the issues that face Australia today. So tonight's platform conversation is the first of an ongoing series that will unfold over the next years. As it gets more difficult for us to mount exhibitions or to rely on exhibitions to cover all subjects of moment, we will need to rely more heavily on such public engagements as these conversations if we are to remain relevant and responsive. It's particularly timely that this conversation examining Indigenous recognition in our Constitution is taking place in NAIDOC Week, always an important week in the National Museum's calendar. I'd like to thank all of the speakers this evening, and I'd like to thank the National Museum of Australia team who've worked hard to finesse this presentation and who are already hard at work on a forward program of future platform conversations. And now I would like you to please welcome Agnes Shea, who will welcome us to country.
Thank you, and good evening, everyone. Nice to see you all this evening. But firstly, I'd like to say thank you to the museum for inviting myself. I'm one of the Ngunnawal elders, and my daughter, Kathy, and my niece, Joanne. On behalf of the three of us, we're very proud to be here to participate in this wonderful and special event. And I do feel honoured to be here to welcome you to such a significant occasion. We are here for the museum's first public conversation on the subject that is very important for the first Australians of this country and important to all Australians who live on Ngunnawal land. It is fitting that the first topic about our place in the Constitution, our nation's foundation document. I would like to acknowledge the expert panel who will debate whether recognising Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island people in the Constitution will make a meaningful difference to our lives. And now I'd like to acknowledge them, the Honourable Mal Brush, Miss Alison Page, Professor Gart Neckham, Mr. David Spears from Sky News. A special welcome to all of you to Ngunnawal country, the country of our ancestors. Also, I'd like to extend a very special welcome to all of our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander friends who've joined us tonight. And as an elder, I do extend that welcome also to all elders, regardless of your cultures. I would like to acknowledge Andrew Sayers, the director of the museum, and his staff for the public showing their support for one of the most pressing issues of our times, our rightful place in this nation. Finally, I would like to especially acknowledge my niece, Margot Neal, a highly respected member of our community, and also to honour her 90-year-old mother, also grandma, Ivy, who Margot and her family looks after at their home. The museum is very lucky to have Margot as the principal Indigenous advisor and a senior curator. She has done remarkable work at the museum for her people across Australia and also around the world, and for many years, and she helps so many of our young people to get on and find their way in modern society, but also to achieve their goals. And now I'd just like to do what I normally do is welcome people to the Ngunnawal country and also explain the meaning of that welcome. The traditional welcoming people is a cultural practice that was handed down by our old people from the beginning of time. What it means, before entering another person's country, you would always announce your arrival and not enter until a traditional owner of that country welcomed you. And the reason for this practice is to protect your spirit while you're in another person's country, but also show respect to the people of the country you're entering. And as one of the Ngunnawal elders, I'm now very proud to see when non-Indigenous organisations and government do ask an elder to come and do welcome to country, it shows that they are also respecting our traditional culture. And it helps to build the reconciliation and bring respect between many cultures of people who now live in the ACT and region, but also throughout Australia. And now I'll finish in the words of the Ngunnawal people, like I normally do, and that is Nagana Yarrabai Yangu, which means you're welcome to leave your footprints on our land now, or in other words, welcome to Ngunnawal country. Thank you, and please enjoy the rest of the evening.
Agnes, thank you so much for that warm welcome to country. I'd like to also pay my respects and recognise the traditional owners of the land, the Ngunnawal people. My name's David Spears. I'm not a doctor, unfortunately. I'm not an expert on this topic either. I'm here as a moderator, a facilitator for tonight. I'm a journalist. I work at Sky News up at Parliament House. And I must say, it's great to be spending a night not talking about the carbon tax. It feels like it might come up, you never know. It seems it's all we talk about at the moment, but there are some pretty important other things happening in our nation at the moment, and tonight we are exploring one of them, there's no doubt about that. Indigenous recognition in the Constitution isn't just an issue for Indigenous Australians, it's an issue for all Australians, but of course it's a question about how do you do it properly, what do you say, where do you put recognition in the Constitution, when should we do it? How do you build consensus on this? And that's some of what we want to explore tonight with who genuinely are three experts on this topic. I should also thank Andrew for his opening remarks and for having us in this beautiful venue tonight. It's wonderful to be here. And also for outlining the philosophy of this platform conversation idea, which I think is a great one, and it's great to hear the philosophy, and I hope that we can live up to it tonight. If we don't, I'm blaming you three. I think it's a great format. I'm really excited about it. As you probably know, we're going to hear from each of our speakers. They'll speak for around 10 minutes each. We'll then have a bit of Q&A, where I'll get to ask the questions. Then we'll have a bit more Q&A, where you'll get to ask the questions. Now, please start thinking about what you want to ask. We want to hear some good questions tonight, and don't be afraid if you think you've got a dumb question. I can tell you they're always the best ones. So have a think about what you want to say. There will be a microphone roaming around a little later. So let's get into it. We also have some questions from the website too, which have been coming in, and I'll throw a few of those in as well. They won't be too curly, don't worry. Alison Page is going to speak first. Alison is a Ngunnawal. Have I said that right? Ngunnawal. Ngunnawal woman from the beautiful south coast of New South Wales, which Canberrans would know very well. She's an artist and a designer and a member of the expert panel on constitutional recognition of Indigenous Australians. You may also recognise her from ABC's New Inventors. Alison has also recently taken up a position at Arts Mid-North Coast, working with 10 communities in the region to put Aboriginal culture on the map with the Saltwater Freshwater Festival. Please make Alison welcome.
Thank you, David, and thank you, Auntie Agnes, for your very warm welcome to country. And I too would like to acknowledge that the traditional owners on the land on whose land we are meeting tonight. I'd also like to thank the National Museum of Australia for organising tonight's very important debate on how Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders could be recognised in the Australian Constitution. In my experience, discussions on Aboriginal issues all too often become bogged down in the perceived problems, the negatives rather than the positives, past mistakes rather than future solutions. Well, tonight you won't be hearing any negatives from me because that's not who I am. I'm a great believer in that old saying that stumbling blocks are there to be made into stepping stones. With constitutional recognition, the way is open for us to take a giant step forward in bringing all Australians together. It's a big challenge for all of us. With only half the Australian population even aware that we have a written constitution, it's not surprising that Australia has only approved 8 out of 44 referenda in the past. With such low popular appreciation of our nation's founding document, we're really starting at first base. But even so, it's important to remember the progress and great achievements we've made in the nation in reconciliation since the Constitution was written back in 1901. When I think of my own family, that change has been transformational. My dad was a young working man growing up in South Sydney, but it wasn't until he was 25 that he was finally counted as an Australian citizen in one of the nation's most successful referendums. Up until then, he, as with all other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people at that time, were put in the same category as flora and fauna. It's hard to put into words how he must have felt at the launch of his own daughter's Aboriginal jewellery collection at the Queen Victoria Building in Sydney, you know, watching all these people fawning over contemporary Aboriginal jewellery. It was a surge of pride that he'd never felt before. The 1967 referendum changed my father's life, and it changed mine too, even though I wasn't even born yet. It was a turning point in this nation's history. And now, 44 years later, we've got another opportunity to take a big leap forward. We've got the chance to give positive recognition to the contribution of the world's oldest living cultures to our national identity. This opportunity is fuelled by an ever-growing reconciliation movement that 10 years ago saw a million people march in support of reconciliation in cities and towns across Australia. This same spirit of reconciliation has seen 252 reconciliation action plans launched, with another 240 under development. This means an estimated 1.6 million Australian workers are being invited to learn and experience Aboriginal culture. And there's also unprecedented support across the political spectrum. All political parties and the independents have given in-principle support to constitutional recognition. But what does it mean? Constitutional recognition could take many different forms. For example, it could mean recognising the distinct and unique cultures of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and their continuing custodianship of the land. It could mean substantive action to protect Indigenous culture and heritage. It could also mean the repeal of discriminatory provisions in the Constitution that have the potential to adversely affect Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and other groups as well. I know some people question the practical benefits of constitutional recognition, and this is an argument I expect will be raised here tonight. But I believe there's a very strong connection between the recognition and practical and sustainable change on the ground. If we're to end this shocking disparity in life expectancy between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Australians, we need to take a creative approach that flips the argument from the negative to the positive. It means changing the perceptions of young Aboriginal people growing up in Australia right now who believe being born Aboriginal has no benefits at all. I mean, who can blame them for thinking that, when Indigenous disadvantage is one of the most commonly used phrases in the debate on Aboriginal issues today, particularly in the media? It's no wonder many Aboriginal people grow up thinking that their identity is something to deny, that their heritage is a ball and chain and something to overcome. This has to change if these young people are going to have a future. And I know that from my own experience. You know, I spent the first part of my life being ashamed of my Aboriginality, but I've really grown up to be someone who now can't scream it loud enough from the rooftops of how proud I am of my heritage. It's fair to say that I'm a product of the growing appreciation of what a gift Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander culture brings to this country. As an Aboriginal designer, I've been able to forge an award-winning career, harnessing my cultural identity in design and architecture. My work is an expression of my identity, and I want more young Aboriginal people to experience this same satisfaction and pride. And this is not just my story. There are so many other success stories as well. We've got Aboriginal doctors, we've got Aboriginal lawyers, Aboriginal academics, and just yesterday I spent the day with Australia's leading Aboriginal architects. You know, many Australian people would be surprised to know that while Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders only make up 3% of the population, we make up over half of our Australian artists, and that's something that I learnt from our friend Mark O'Neill here at the museum. This is the type of over-representation that I like to hear and I rejoice in, not the tragic over-representation that we get rammed down our throats by the media all the time that tells me that I'm 8 times more likely to go to jail or I'm 14 times more likely to go to a juvenile justice centre. Again, we need to turn this equation around. We need to focus on the positive instead of always looking at the negatives. This is essential for the over 50% of our people who are 19 years or younger. It's 50% of our mob are 19 years or younger. It's a lot of young people coming through, and that's why constitutional recognition is so important. It will give young Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people new pride in their heritage, so that they can grow up understanding that their culture is an advantage, not a disadvantage. I'm not saying that recognition is a silver bullet and that it's going to solve the wicked problems that face our communities on a day-to-day basis, but I'm saying that attitude and the attitude of our country matters, and that a positive attitude can pave the way to finding solutions for our people. I believe too that the solutions to the problems facing Aboriginal Australia will come from within, from our own people and from our own culture. Culture can unlock the potential of our young people, socially and economically. And for this to happen, our culture needs to be fully understood, it needs to be appreciated, and it needs to be respected. I think we can take this a step further and make the case that sharing values at the heart of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures can benefit all Australians. Storytelling, art, language, the importance of extended families, our connection to country. These are all values that are relevant to all of us. For example, in facing the challenges around sustainability and caring for our environment, we can learn so much from the cultural practices of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. Many Australians agree with me. The 2010 Reconciliation Australia Barometer revealed that 70% of the general community think that Indigenous culture is important to Australians' identity as a nation. 70% think that it's important for our national identity. 80% think that it's important for all Australians to get to know Aboriginal culture. I would like to conclude by reminding those who are sceptical about the value of words to remember just how much the word sorry meant in 2008 and how the unity of our nation has been strengthened in the years since. We must never underestimate the value of words and their impact on the self-esteem of a person, a community, and on a nation as a whole. Coming up with a form of words to enshrine recognition in the Constitution, it's something that we can do at a national level that's going to make our job easy at a local level, or easier at a local level. Of course, we all know that we could pull up our sleeves and set about making practical changes, but I'm convinced that with hope and positive self-esteem, we'll be able to make the kind of transformational change that means we'll no longer have the reason to use the words Indigenous disadvantage. Thanks very much.
Alison, thank you for that great presentation and some messages there for us all, I think particularly us in the media, about what we should be doing. I might take you up on some of that a bit later. If we can't have bad news, what are we going to write about? Now, some of the resistance to Indigenous recognition in the Constitution is often bound up in the argument, well, what's it going to mean for legal rights? Is it going to open the door to compensation? That sort of thing. Well, our next speaker, Garth Nettheim, is a leading academic expert on Indigenous legal rights. He's the founding director of the University of New South Wales Indigenous Law Centre, and he's a prominent public commentator on these issues, treaties, bills and rights and other human rights protections. He was also involved in the Mabo case, so has a long history of involvement in this area. Please welcome Garth to the stage.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Agnes, for the welcome to your country. And I too wish to acknowledge the traditional owners. When settlers move into a country populated by Indigenous peoples, they have an option as to whether or not to recognise the Indigenous inhabitants. In many cases, it makes a lot of good sense to do so. When the Romans invaded Britain, they provided some recognition to the British. When the Britain itself provided some recognition when it moved into North America and New Zealand. Typically, the recognition takes the form of some sort of treaty between the newcomers and their predecessors. The nature and content of such a treaty will vary from one situation to another. It may be taken as applying to all the people in the lands and a newly settled colony, as with New Zealand, or it may deal only with particular subsets or tribes or geographical regions. Thus, in the colonisation of North America by European powers, treaties were made in some areas, but not all. Such treaties generally have had no constitutional status. Many have been downplayed or even ignored as the newcomers have become more powerful. In most colonised lands, the Indigenous peoples have, as Alison was saying, become disadvantaged over the centuries. Now, what about Australia? When Captain Cook was instructed in 1768 what to do if he found the east coast of Australia, he was told to obtain the consent of the natives. Such consent was not obtained then, nor has it been obtained since. When such treaties have been negotiated, they've been regarded as best as contracts between the peoples concerned, and not having the force of law in international law that treaties have between nation states in dealing with such matters as trade. It's largely only since the World War II that international treaty law has begun to focus on the rights and well-being of people living within states. This is human rights law, which has been developing since the establishment of the United Nations in 1945. Some provisions for multilateral human rights treaties have been held to apply to Indigenous peoples, which has been relevant to Australia. More recently, some international instruments have begun to focus specifically on Indigenous peoples. One example is the International Labour Organization Convention of 1989. But most recently still, after some 25 years of development, the UN General Assembly in September 2007 adopted not a treaty, but a Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, DRIP, UNDRIP for short. Australia initially declined to support the measure, as did three other countries, New Zealand, Canada and the United States, but a massive majority of members voted in the favour. Subsequently, on the 3rd of April 2009, the Australian government agreed to support the declaration. What difference do these developments made in our respective nations? First, it's worth noting that if Indigenous peoples are thought to have constitutional status, this may involve recognition of the following rights, among others, some or all of them: sovereignty, or self-determination, or self-government, or territorial and resources rights, or cultural rights. These are the primary focus of the declaration. In the United States, after the American Revolution, the US legal system was prepared to acknowledge that Indian nations possessed at least some of the indicia of sovereignty, and the Constitution itself acknowledges them as distinct entities in the legislative power assigned to Congress to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. In the first years of the US Supreme Court, the Marshall decisions acknowledged Indian title and a degree of Indian sovereignty. US law still recognised the right of internal self-government and degree of sovereign immunity in Indian nations, especially on Indian lands. Canada did not follow US jurisprudence recognising a degree of Indigenous sovereignty, but a process of negotiating treaties continues to this day, plus some constitutional and common law recognition of an inherent right to self-government. The Constitution Act of 1982 is very important in this regard. Federal government policy has been, in those years, to negotiate self-government for Indigenous peoples on Indigenous lands with respect to a wide range of matters. Some of the treaties have been very important, like the Nunavut, which takes a big chunk of what used to be the Northwest Territory and made it a self-sustaining territory with an Inuit majority in the Canadian Federation. As to New Zealand, the Treaty of Waitangi in 1840, Maori ceded sovereignty in return for protection of their exclusive possession of their lands. But over the years, Maori rights were read down, but it was given a fresh lease of life in 75, extended in 1985, though solely on the basis of statute. In Australia, there was no such consent, no treaty, no recognition. But since in recent years, there has been a considerable degree of recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders since the 1960s. As Alison pointed out, particularly with the enactment of land rights legislation together with some constitutional changes, notably the very important referendum of 67. A further and major breakthrough was, of course, the High Court decision in Mabo in 1992. The High Court took into account judicial precedents from other lands to hold that Australia's inheritance and common law included recognition of native title. It also drew on principles of international law. The decision was followed by legislation. The Native Title Act. The focus has now shifted to constitutional recognition. It's now 110 years since the commencement of the Commonwealth of Australia Constitution Act, a British Act of 1900. One notable feature of the Constitution is the procedure for amendment, which makes things very difficult, as Alison pointed out, of some sort of 44 proposals put to the people. In referenda, only 8 have succeeded. First of all, the proposal has to be put before the people, and has to be passed by an absolute majority in both houses of Parliament and then submitted to a referendum. At the referendum, it has to be approved not just by a majority of the voters overall, but also by a majority of voters in a majority of states. Then, if it succeeds, it's presented to the Governor-General for the Royal Assent. So that's one feature. Another feature was the race power as originally enacted. It gave power to the Commonwealth Parliament to legislate with respect to Section 5136, the people of any race other than the Aboriginal race in any state for whom it's deemed necessary to make special laws. In the 1997 referendum, the proposal to delete the words other than the Aboriginal race in any state was supported by an unprecedented 91% of the voters. The amendment was motivated by a belief that Indigenous Australians would be better off if not left subject solely to state legislation. Section 127, the other proposal accepted by the electors in 1967, was to delete Section 127 altogether, which provided that, in reckoning in the numbers of the people of the Commonwealth or of a state or other part of the Commonwealth, Aboriginal natives should not be counted. These two provisions were the only specific references in the Constitution which specifically referred to Indigenous Australians and had been negative. Section 25 is an important provision. The purpose is, I won't go into that now. Other proposals have been put over the years. One of the research brochures put up by Megan Davis and Dylan Lino for the Indigenous Law Centre project at University of New South Wales have listed some 8 previous sources of proposals since 1983, and I won't go into all those at this stage. The proposals for further constitutional change have come to a peak over the past couple of years in particular, and a range of bodies have been considering the matter. I'll mention a few. But first, I note that last year, Prime Minister Gillard announced her support for constitutional recognition and her intention to establish an expert panel to identify suitable changes. And on the eve of the 2010 election, it became clear that there's strong degree of cross-party support for a referendum in the near future, during the life of this Parliament, or at least before the next election. The time is ripe. It remains to identify specific proposals and to select those which have a reasonable chance of success. Otherwise, failure could set the course back for another decade or more. A critical element this time around is that Aboriginal people in Torres Strait Islands must be fully engaged in the process and preferably be given the chance to decide for themselves the terms on which particular proposals are to be couched. I mentioned the Indigenous Law Centre project. They've talked about 6 of the most frequently suggested amendments, a non-discrimination provision, a new preamble, amendment or deletion of the race power, deletion of Section 25, a provision for which they particularly favour as being the ones to put forward, in addition to others, a provision for agreement making between Indigenous people and the state, and recognition of pre-existing Aboriginal land rights or native title. They proposed the first four from that list. In April this year, the Law Council of Australia released a 35-page discussion paper called Constitutional Recognition of Indigenous Australians. I strongly recommend that that's a highly useful source of information. The Law Council is seeking submissions in response to its discussion paper by the 31st of August. In the meantime, it will, in 2 weeks' time, here in Canberra, hold a discussion forum at Old Parliament House. That should be quite an interesting operations. It identifies five issues and provides excellent background on them. The preamble, Section 25, Section 5126, equality and non-discrimination, and constitutional references, conferences and agreements. There's an important paper put out earlier this year by the Australian Human Rights Commission. Mick Gooder produced an important report called Constitutional Reform, Creating a Nation for All of Us. This too is an excellent source of information and ideas. ANTAR, the Australians for Native Title and Reconciliation, has been provided good running commentary plus access to download attachments from various sources. I received a very useful mailing from ANTAR only yesterday. Lastly, the expert panel. They released their own discussion panel in May 2011 entitled A National Conversation about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Constitutional Recognition. That too is very well worth looking at, and it's being discussed around the country by Alison and by other members of the expert panel. Meantime, the world is watching via such processes as the Special Rapporteur or through the Universal Periodic Review of Nation Reports and so on. Let's hope you get things right this time around. Thank you.
Thanks for that. And I'm sure there'll be some who want to explore the background there and what sort of question would be likely to get up in that context. Now, our next speaker, Mal Brough, many of you would recognise, was a minister in the Howard government for Family and Community Services and Indigenous Affairs. He was the architect and certainly the public face of the Northern Territory Emergency Response, better known as the Intervention. The package of measures that, of course, was implemented just before the Howard government lost office, following the report of high rates of child sexual abuse in particular in Northern Territory remote communities. Mal Brough has now declared this intervention policy a failure under the Gillard government, given we've seen escalating levels of violence in some of these communities. He continues to call for a zero-tolerance approach on alcohol, drug and welfare dependency. Please make Mal Brough welcome.
Thank you very much, David, and to the elders, thank you very much for the warm welcome to your country, and it's great to be back here in Canberra and to this esteemed location. Tonight's supposed to be a conversation, so the last thing I want to do is be seen to be speaking at people. I just want to share with you some of my views, some of my feelings on this issue, and perhaps get people to think a little bit about some of the unintended consequences about where we're going. Let me say at the outset, something's really clear. To me, it's appalling that we're even having this discussion. I said to my wife on the way down in the plane today, and she said this should have been done 110 years ago. And it should have been. It shouldn't even be an issue for us. And I think it's a reflection of us as a people that it is. It's a reflection that we didn't count people, that we saw one person lesser than others, that we didn't let people have a vote, that we thought that that was somehow appropriate. And it won't be long before university students look back and go, I don't believe that's the country that I'm part of that was just that generation ago even having to have this debate. So let me make it very clear, unambiguous, even to the media, David, that... He's taking notes, good. Hasn't helped in the past. That I don't know what form this will take, and it's great that we have a constitutional law expert here because I'm not a lawyer. I have no legal training, but I know what's right and what's right in my heart and I think isn't right in the heart of most Australians, and that there needs to be a recognition of the reality, the indisputable fact that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders are the first people of this nation, and that they should have a very important part to play in the document that really governs us, which is our constitution. Alison pointed out that only half of the population know what a constitution is, so I'm surprised it's that high. But I know that I've asked people, learned people, tell me how big's the constitution? Oh, you know, this big. Well, it is about that big, if you print it on big sheets, and it's about four pages. But it's so important. It's so important because the fact that it's hard to change is not a bad thing, it's a good thing, because it means we're now going to have to focus on it. So let's talk about focusing on it, because I think it will get through, and I hope that the discussions that the committee's having right now, the expert panel, comes back with something that no one can, you know, other than a few ratbags, will find cause to argue with, and that we can just move on. If we can just do that, that's great. However, here are the issues that I want to have people think about. Most of us are pretty busy in our lives. We're all focused on this carbon tax thing that David talked about, and I promise you I'm not talking about a carbon tax. I thought this would be a carbon tax-free zone. But people, it's a reflection of just wanting to live and wanting to get on with our own lives and getting our own children, our own parents and our own grandparents to a place where we feel safe and secure. And so thinking about these big questions or thinking about the disadvantage that other Australians have, whether it be in the field of disabilities or whether it be in the field of Indigenous affairs, is something that doesn't exercise many people's minds on a day-to-day basis. But when it does on a question like this, or the sorry question, or the referendum, for too many people, I fear that they go, oh, that's good, we've fixed that now. And therefore, they go back to their own important things in their own lives and try and get on with it. That is a problem. Because I hear it day to day when people stop me in the street to say, you know, aren't you pleased what's happening with the intervention? Aren't you pleased that's all fixed? And I go, well, if you think the disadvantage that these people are still suffering today is fixed, yeah, it's bloody great. But it's not. Just because it's not in the media and it's been dealt with doesn't mean that people's lives have the same right to flourish as yours and I and our children's do. And I worry that for mainstream Australia, that they will see job done. It is important. It is symbolism. But it's very significant symbolism. But it's not job done. And I think we have to underpin this discussion with we can walk and chew gum too. And there is an enormous amount of things that still need to be done to give people hope and aspiration and a chance in life, which are not being done today. The second group that I want to discuss are the people who this is all about, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people of this country. The ones that I have unashamedly focused on more than any other are those in the remote parts of this country, the ones who don't have access and haven't had access to a decent education, a decent diet, let alone decent healthcare, who, quite frankly, often still live in conditions that people would find appalling if only they could go and see it for themselves, but it seems to be somewhere else. And Alison, I don't want to talk about negatives, and I share with you your passion for wanting to be positive, but too many people just don't understand these things happen in our country and our backyard. For those children, this won't change the circumstances in their life. As important as it is to us, and as important it is to us as a nation, it won't change them. And I don't, again, want too many people to use this as an excuse or as a crutch or as an alternative to taking meaningful action. So the third group, one that I was a breed of, politicians. Yes, I can be quite cynical about people's motivations, because I know it has been a policy, a deliberate policy of both the Rudd and the Gillard government to say and to keep Indigenous affairs out of the media. And I think it's wrong. I don't mean you need to be out there harping every day about negativities, etc., but I think that we need to have a discourse with the population which brings them in and engages people in Melbourne and Sydney and Brisbane as much as in the remote parts of this country about the challenges that face people around the nation, not in any exclusive locality. Keep saying that we're working on it. we haven't got it right. There's more to be done, but we need you to be part of that solution. And we seem to not want to face that. So I don't want to see this become an opportunity for politicians also to put the queue in the rack and say, haven't we done a great job? Because we haven't. We've done an appalling job. And we need to do so much more. So, ladies and gentlemen, as part of my discourse with you and sharing my views, I am unambiguous in saying that whatever form this take, I trust that the legal fraternity will get it right. I know that's a big statement. But I think there's a lot of goodwill. And I think that the papers that were referred to in regard to the Law Council are very insightful, and that they're very instructive, and more people need to see them. But let's not kid ourselves. The average Australian's not going to think about this until the last moment, and they'll turn up at the polling booths and say, now what are we voting for? And all we need them to do is to say and have in their heart that this is another positive step forward. But if at the same time we can share and have them thinking that this is not the end of the road for disadvantage, this is not going to fix that individual, those individuals who are racist, those people who deny the past and will deny children a future simply because it's too easy for them to close their eyes and their minds to what the reality is. I actually think that the people sitting here in front of us today have just as important role to play via social media and via conversations to share the conversation that you've heard tonight, to share what's clearly your passion for this, but to get the equation right. Let's let it happen, let's make it happen, but let's not do so at the expense of the practical measures we all need to take in our own lives, in our own communities, and in our governments and in our nation to ensure that the next generation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders have more as a group of Australians to look forward to than some of those that many of us have had the despair of seeing over the last 50 years.
Malbruff, thank you very much for that, and I'll get you to throw on your Madonna head mic as well so we can all look idiotic together. A lot of food for thought there, a lot to pursue. Please, as I said, start thinking about the questions you want to ask. I'm going to kick things off, though. Going back, Alison, to what you were saying, you said that recognition in the Constitution is an opportunity for a big leap forward. What difference is it going to make in the lives of Indigenous Australians?
Well, I think that we can, you know, throw all the services and all the money at, Indigenous disadvantage in communities to try and solve the Aboriginal issue. But really, I think if you're throwing it at people who are broken, who are downtrodden, who have no sense of hope for the future, who have no feel like they have no control over their own lives, then I think all you're coming up with is band-aid measures.
Mm. So what does this do?
This is a fundamental shift, I think, in the attitude of the whole country towards the whole Aboriginal issue, in actually just saying, well, okay, well, let's just change this from a negative to a positive. Let's start by recognising that your heritage and your culture. So the very next day after we've had recognition, I want a young Aboriginal person to spring out of bed and look in the mirror and be proud of who they are. Because even though they're going to need a lot of energy to tackle that the issues that they're facing, that their parents are facing, their brothers and sisters are facing every day, they're going to have at least the energy and the hope and the sense of pride and the determination to be able to pull up their own sleeves and solve their own problems.
Well, is it going to do that? I mean, I know you've been part of the expert panel, and I just want you to tease out what's coming up in the consultation process. There's been a lot of consultation mm-hmm. around the country, and a lot of remote communities in particular, and I know you've been part of this. And as you pointed out in your speech, 50% of the Indigenous population is younger than 19.
Mm.
Now, that's pretty staggering for us to think about. We're talking about kids here.
Yeah.
How much attention are they going to pay to what's in the Constitution?
Well, surprisingly, you know, look, there's a lot of young people in the audience tonight, and, you know, there's been a lot of young people who have been really engaged in this whole debate, and that's Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people who are engaged in the debate. And from our polling, we've learnt that actually they want to inherit a modern Australia that actually starts to look at things in a different kind of a light and in a more positive light. So,
do they see themselves as second-class citizens?
Young Aboriginal
yes.
people? I think that, you know, really, with all the messages that they get in terms of... I think there's a lot of... What you don't hear about in the media are people like me, people in my age group who, you know, we did spend the first... Like NAIDOC when I was growing up, you know, Mum used to pull me out of school and, you know, we'd go marching down the main street of Coffs Harbour as a big protest. You know, it was so embarrassing. But now, you know, NAIDOC, this week, today, all over the country, there's all these amazing celebrations that are happening, and I can just see that there is an incremental change. But the actual, the power of the nation actually turning around and saying that your culture and your heritage, that you are the custodians of, you know, has an enormous value to us and to our story. It is very important. It's a part of us, who we are as a nation. You know, can you imagine the kind of pride that they would have, you know, rather than, you know, hearing about it, you know, the fact that it's something that they need to overcome, this disadvantage, you know, that what it means to be Aboriginal is I'm going to probably be on welfare payments, I'm probably going to live on an Aboriginal mission, I'm probably going to, you know, be pregnant by the time I'm 16, I'm probably going, you know, and all of these things, rather than hearing, you know, the really positive stories, you know, of me, you know, people my age and our colleagues who, you know, I'm having a great life. I've been, you know, working in Aboriginal architecture. Which, you know, like when I very first heard that phrase, I couldn't believe. I said, what? Aboriginal architecture? Are you kidding me? You know, what a provocative term. And these are the things that no one's really heard. I've lived this for 15 years, but that story's not out there, and that's what needs to get out there.
Your story, though, look, and I think this is a really interesting issue that you raise, and I think it's a fair cop for the media that we don't focus enough on the positive stories. Agree with that 100%. But your story isn't perhaps typical of a lot of the stories that are real amongst Indigenous Australians in Marlborough.
I disagree with that. No, I disagree. Well,
typical. There's a lot of those stories. There's thousands of those stories.
And a lot of people may say, oh, yeah, but, you know, you've probably been brought up in, you know, with access to education. I was brought up in a family of six girls with a single mother. You know, and we had... The starting point of my story is the starting point of the story of every Aboriginal person.
Tell me about it.
Well, you know, single mother, six kids, food parcels from St Vinny's. You know, like all of the stats were stacked up against me. But, you know, when I...
You mentioned a turning point where you went from being ashamed to being just so proud
Aboriginality. When I met some other Aboriginal people my age that were just starting to feel a sense of pride in themselves as well. And I think the camaraderie that we felt as a group, where we were like, no, this is good. And it doesn't have to be us out there shouting in the streets, you know, or shouting, you know, protest kind of messages, where actually we could engage with other people around us and our non-Aboriginal friends around us and engage in what are the Aboriginal cultural values, you know? And we're really starting at that point because I wasn't really taught about what, you know, I didn't have the, you know, wise old grandmother that took me away and told me all of the cultural values. They're things that unfolded to me and have unfolded to me you know, throughout my story, over time.
I could keep asking you questions all night, but I want to bring in the other panellists as well. Marlborough, you were seeming to suggest that this, well, in fact, your words were, this shouldn't be, I told you I was taking notes, this shouldn't be a crutch for inaction. Are you saying that there is a danger that if we focus too much on the Constitution and inclusion in the Constitution, you're going to take your eye off the ball of closing the gap on disadvantage?
Mate, there was a time when, if I'd asked to be in this forum, I would have been opposed to this simply because I think it would have been a distraction. Because that's what politicians do. Politicians love distractions. And as I said, I'm cynical, and I sort of think, well, what was the motivation here? But I don't care. You take it on face value or not, this is important, it needs to happen.
Walk and chew gum, you said.
Yeah, walk and chew gum. I don't think there is a government in the country doing enough, and closing the gap is not a policy, it is a slogan. Mm. There's no policy there. It could even be called an aspiration if you want to be generous. I'm not here to be political, but it's not a policy. You know, so let's get over that. Let's talk about... I love Alison's enthusiasm and passion for what you want to see happen. It's not the reality of what kids will wake up with, unfortunately. And what I'm saying is that's our aspiration of what we want to see them do and feel and be, but that won't be their experience. And this isn't going to change that, but it doesn't mean it shouldn't happen. And my whole argument, David, is don't sit there and say, aren't we great, us white fellas? Look what we've done. We've given those black fellas some recognition, and the world's great. No, the world's not great. The world is actually damn terrible for a lot of people, and a lot more needs to be done, as well as giving them a recognition that should have been there from day one. And I think, as was pointed out, was taken in such a way by good Captain Cook not to even have followed orders. And God, as a former army officer, he didn't follow orders. It's a wonder he wasn't hung, drawn and quartered. But he didn't. We can't fix those things, but we can deal with something today, but deal with that. But get the balance, show the positive stories, but not again at the expense of closing your eyes to the pain and the deprivation that is there.
Garth, you spoke about the history of dealing with these treaty issues. Of course, there's a history on this question as well. In 1999, there was a referendum. Everyone remembers it, the Republic referendum. There's also a question put up that few people seem to recall now. It was on Indigenous recognition in the Constitution, and it was defeated. Why did it fail?
I think it failed partly because of the Republic issue.
It was conflated too much.
Which divided those who favoured a republic into two categories, depending on how they saw it being achieved. So that was looked like a failure, and was a failure. I think also the problem with the preamble recognition was that the wording had not been carried through and consulted about to everybody's satisfaction. And I think the critical thing then, which has to be addressed in any further attempt to change the Constitution, is it is very important, critically important, that Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islanders should be fully engaged in the development of a proposal, and particularly in the wording of it. And it should be apparent that the wording proposed for a proposal is one which has the support of major Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and principal organisations like the New Congress, which is just taking shape at the present time. So certainly this time around, I would hope to see that any ideas which are being floated and developed on the basis of the proposals which I talked about needs to be the wording or the concepts at least have to be put before Aboriginal people so that they can have the opportunity to come to conclusions about it.
Well, the
work of the expert panel in particular
is a big part of that, a big part of that consultation. I want to get to the wording shortly and what words are important.
Well, David, what's the bigger question is what happens if the Aboriginal community, which is as diverse as everyone else, can't agree on it, on either the format, the words, or the process?
Well, Alison, maybe a question to you there.
Well, I think that, we're having a national conversation now around, how best to recognise Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the Constitution. And one of the things that the panel is focusing very heavily on is consultation with the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community. Yep. And the conversation is varied and the opinions are broad. But one thing that everyone agrees on is that it is a positive step forward.
But if there can't be agreement on the words, what do you do?
I think that the consultation process really has to look at, testing out these things and testing out some words. I mean, but ultimately, what I love about the conversation and what's really engaging about the conversation is that, and it's engaging not only Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, but the broader community as well, is what do we hope to achieve out of it? Mm-hmm. And actually the conversation is about what is going to happen in 20, 25 years time, what kind of effect will this have if it's seen in context of a whole range of other steps that will happen or will follow as a consequence of that. And I think that goes back to what you're saying, that it's not... it can't be seen as, you know, a silver bullet, and it's not a step unto itself. It is a part of a continuum.
There's another tricky question, though, for you guys. What if you get to the end of this process and you fear that a referendum question would be lost? Do you still go ahead with it, or do you pull back?
No, and I think that's what's so fantastic about the opportunity to have this national conversation is that we're planting a seed here, and we suspect that the weather's good for that seed to take root.
To make it happen, though, and Garth, back to you on this.
If the weather's not good, you know, and we can only, you know, predict it as well as any other weatherman, if the weather's not good, now's not the time.
And as we know with the Republic question, if a referendum goes down, it's a long time before the question comes back again, and it's... 12 years now since...
But we've been waiting over 200 years, so, you know, we can wait a little bit longer.
as you point out, though, one of the reasons it was lost in 99 was because it was tied up with the Republic question. The government also wants to include local government in the Constitution. That would be a referendum question as well, and there's the question about whether you put this up in an election or do you have a separate referendum to deal with this. What do you think, Garth? Does this need to be on its own, not tied up with any other questions about changing the Constitution, and does it need to be separate from a federal election?
I think probably it does. Well, let's see. I think a lot depends on how you go about developing a particular proposal or set of proposals. And if you take this consultation process and follow it through widely, particularly on these issues, whether if you get the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples actually and principally involved, then once you know that you've got something which has general support, then it's possible to combine, and I would think it's possible to combine a few issues together. Mm.
So would the local government one, for example, be a problem in this issue?
It could be. It just depends on how the preparation goes.
Mm. Well, what do you think, Mel?
I think that, a Noel Pearson or a Pat Dodson, I'm not saying for one moment they would, don't get me wrong, don't read anything into this, I'm not you, but people that are big personalities that people listen to, the Weecher or Donoghue, could potentially derail it because they went in a different direction. If you then wrap that up with other proposals, and you don't know those things, you go back to the referendum on becoming a republic. Well, the general public wanted to become a republic, but some people said it was very interesting politics by somebody that made a question split the people. So you could actually have Aboriginal Australians on two sides of the argument. Then people get confused because they won't invest the time. I mean, talking about the great populace. Yeah. If he says or she says, maybe I shouldn't. So the arguments are it costs too much. Well, I think your point is absolutely right. I mean, after all of this time, give me a break. It deserves to stand alone on its own. It deserves to be the centre of attention. It deserves to get the media and the public's attention and to be dealt with. And it should be done, in my view, outside of an election campaign when you're just going to get all of the noise of the 24-hour news cycle and this just gets lost. And then they turn up and they go, I've given you a third bit of paper. What do you mean? Oh, you know, you've got this thing. I think that's too big a risk.
Yeah.
And I hope that the issues can be overcome so that... I think it would be a real slight on us as a nation if we get to the end of the process that the expert panel's part of and we go, nah, we're not actually mature enough yet and ready enough to actually put this to the people.
Well, it all comes down, I guess, in the end to the words. I want to just quickly read you what was in the 1999 proposed, and this was in the preamble of the Constitution, and that's another question. Where does it go in the preamble? Does it go in the body of the Constitution? The words then that were suggested, honouring Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders, the nation's first people, for their deep kinship with their lands and for their ancient and continuing cultures which enrich the life of our country. There was debate about the word kinship. There were suggestions it should be ownership. People were worried about lawsuits following it and claims and whatnot, compensation. So it was changed to kinship. What sort of words do you think need to be in whatever's included? Alison? I'm not sure if you can talk about this as part of the panel, can you? Or?
Oh, no, look, there's a lot of ideas that are being talked about as part of the consultations. And I think, you know, words like, you know, the acknowledgement of the world's oldest living culture, I think acknowledging Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders' continued custodianship of the land, that, you know, respect, you know, these sorts of words, they're all, I think they're things that people agree on. Look, I personally think, you know, that really I think the fact that we've only ever had 8 out of 44, I just think, you know, that it's really important when you put a question to the Australian public when it comes to the Constitution, it just needs to be quite simple. I mean, we know that from past referenda. It's not just about Aboriginal issues. It's about every issue that really you can't, I don't think you can dovetail it with a whole range of other things like the local government thing. That's my personal opinion, because I think that this is a big issue. It's an important issue. And I think that what the recognition is actually doing is it's framing this topic for the Australian public in a way that it has never been framed before, in a different way, in a positive way. And it's not going to right the wrongs of the past, because heavens, I don't know if this nation is really ready to deal with how truly painful the wrongs of the past actually are. And I think that that's something that will be revealed in decades following. But what it is an important open invitation, you know, from the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and for the rest of the nation, for us to engage with each other for the first time in a positive way. And, you know, for that, you know, relationship to blossom, really, into the future.
Getting back to the words, Garth, any suggestions or ideas of what should or should not be included in this?
No, there's been in some of the discussion papers I talked about, there is discussion there, which is worth looking at. I haven't got any firm views at the moment, but I think it's very important that we spend a lot of time, whatever time it takes, to get the wording right before we proceed.
Malbrough?
I agree with the two before me. I mean, it's just not my position to be able to do that, and I couldn't. Respect a good words. You know.
Yeah, oldest living culture.
Oldest living culture. These are just statements of fact, you know, and that's why I think it's, again, important to elevate this to the prominence that it deserves as an issue in our nation by standing alone, and also you run out of excuses. Because just like the 1999, oh, that's because it was put with something else and people always, they vote one no, they vote all no's. That's all probably true. So if it's only there alone, we as a nation don't have an excuse.
And as I said earlier, preamble of the Constitution or in the body of the Constitution, does that matter? Mel, first to you.
If there's a legal perspective, I don't know it. From my perspective is I can't. I don't have any issue with it being in the body of the Constitution and having a prominent role.
Garth, what's the difference here?
Well, there are complications in terms of the legality, because the current preamble to the Constitution is a preamble to the British Act, not an Australian Act, and the Constitution follows the preamble. It's giving the history to the development of the Australian Commonwealth, the Constitution. The substantive portions of the Constitution, once it starts as being enacted, has no preamble whatsoever. So there's a debate as to whether to change the preamble in the British Act, which is extremely complicated because there are processes now under the Statute of Westminster and of 1932 and the Australia Acts of 1986, whereby you'd have to go to develop something through state parliaments, take it to the Commonwealth Parliament, and then get it enacted by the British Parliament, which I don't think people would particularly appreciate. If you go into the Constitution itself and put in a new preamble where there is no preamble at the moment to the Constitution, then if you're dealing with a standalone provision relating to Indigenous peoples, then yes, that could be done, but whether non-Aboriginal people would support the idea of a preamble which talks only about Indigenous peoples is another question. You can go beyond that. It's a recital of the background to Australians' non-European settlement. So there are various options there. Last Friday, the Indigenous Law Centre ran a workshop of constitutional law experts to look at some of these issues. The papers are going to be published fairly shortly in the Australian Indigenous Law Review, and one of the papers in particular by Anne Toomey from the University of Sydney Law School spends some time very lucidly discussing some of the issues about a preamble. But I think that still has to be resolved, where the preamble fits and whether a preamble needs to be standing alone on these issues or whether there also needs to be a statement of values relevant to the broader Australian community. There's still some debate about this.
Yeah. And that's part of the national conversation, in fact, is whether, you know, a statement of values should also be included. I mean, you know, it's one of the options that's being talked about.
I've got, in fact, as I mentioned earlier, a number of questions that have come in on the website as well, and one of them relates to this issue. It's from Nick Parmeter. Do you think it would be a strange result if Australia voted to insert the preamble into the Constitution, recognising Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians, but were not asked to remove racist provisions such as Sections 25 or 5126? Tell us what those sections are, Garth. Help us out.
Show everyone the Constitution. Yeah.
Can I talk about Section 25?
Yes.
And I only... look.
Explain what it is, please.
Yeah, well, only because I really didn't pick up... I'm one of the people that didn't really... I mean, I knew we had a written constitution, but I didn't know anything about it. And Section 25 is one of those sections in the constitution that absolutely shocked me. You know, I couldn't believe that in this day and age, there's a section in there that says that the government, any state government, can decide to not count the vote of any race that it wanted to, you know, in an election. I mean, hello. I mean, I don't know whether... I don't think anyone that would sit comfortably with anyone.
Let me just test
country.
That. Who knew that that was in the Constitution?
Mate, can I tell you something? When I used to do public meetings and some bloke started quoting from the Constitution, I knew...
You're in
the
trouble.
Meeting. No, I knew the meeting was in trouble. I've just taken note of all the new people.
So,
but to me, that's a shocker.
That's got to go.
That's a shocker.
Does
and
anyone,
I would imagine...
Do we know why it's there? Or do we understand the history? Maybe you found that because...
Well, in effect, the Section 25 penalised a state that had not accorded voting rights to Indigenous peoples. And at the time of federation, I think only South Australia had gone down that path. It penalised a state that it has not accorded those rights. In contemplating the people might be deprived of electoral representation on the basis of race, this provision remains offensive to Indigenous Australians, even though they're no longer disqualified from voting on the basis of race. There's a question of whether it should be repealed, and there's a lot of people saying, yes, it should go.
Isn't this about money?
No.
Maybe I've read this wrongly, so incorrectly, but... From what I can understand, from what you've just said there, is that if you as a state government decide, I'm not going to count that bunch of people for whatever reason, therefore when it comes to the Commonwealth Grants Commission, the Commonwealth then penalises you for taking such a bloody-minded attitude, so therefore you won't disqualify them, whoever they are. That's the way I just read that in my legal manner. Am I totally off the planet?
Reading manner, I think political manner.
I think penalises in particular in terms of the... number of seats they have in the House of Representatives.
So it's really, it's a really a positive thing. Is it sort of a safeguard?
It was meant to be a positive.
Yeah. Okay.
To discourage states from discriminating.
From having a bloody-minded attitude.
That's right.
All right. On that, we'll start opening up the floor for questions. We've got a couple of hands up and a microphone over here. So make sure you grab their attention. Just give us your first name and tell us who you're directing the question to.
My name is Rajan. I'd like to direct my question to Alison Page. Alison, states and territories seem to have
Thank
a
you.
Better record of making innovations than does the centre, for example, with bills of rights. Would it be a wise strategy to take forward this kind of recognition first through states and territories before seeking to do it in the federal constitution?
Well, Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria have taken this step and they all have a preambular statement of recognition. I think, and I, you know, talking with people in South Australia, they actually think that these two things could happen concurrently, that we could be talking about federal recognition as well as state recognition at the same time, that I don't think that one has to precede the other. Yeah, look, I welcome every state and territory to do exactly the same thing and to use the debate and the national conversation as a momentum to make changes at their state level.
We've got one over here.
Hello, my name is Ian Bedrissett. I'm a Wonka Murukuri from Sydney, but I've been in the Kimberleys for 20-odd years. And from what I've found out, it seems that to get something through the Australian population, it has to be such a watered-down view that Aboriginal people have that it's going to be meaningless. And why I say that is because I think that it's not about the window dressing that's going to be applied to the preamble that is of a concern to me. My issue is about the functionalness of the Constitution, the way in which it was created by the states to enrich the states and to empower the states as much as they could. So we still, the states, as far as I know, were established as the instruments of colonisation, and they've not been prepared to relinquish that role as colonisers, as we're experiencing in Western Australia now in James Price's Point, north of Broome, where the state government is oppressing Aboriginal people as we speak. So how do we start to look at the changes that have come through native title, that recognise prescribed body corporates as agencies to deliver a whole range of change to different groups, specific tribal groups within Australia? How do we change the way in which the federal government has a relationship for resourcing Aboriginal people so that rather than putting our money, our federal dollars, through the states who cream off a lot and misspend a lot of money, how do we get that directly into Aboriginal hands through the PBC process?
Who wants to tackle that?
Look, I'll give you 2 seconds on it. You know, the grants, the Commonwealth Grants Commission distributes money to each of the states on a bunch of relativities, including disadvantage, Indigenous, remoteness, etc. But there's no requirement upon any state or territory to use that money for that purpose. In the area of Indigenous housing specifically, you know, again, it didn't matter. Part of what I sort of learned as the minister was how do you pan that back and how do you actually make people accountable for it, even if they do it badly, but at least spend that much money. And incredible, you know, some of the best accounting I've ever seen came out of the territory. So if you're a policeman in a police house, that was out of Indigenous affairs, because somewhere on the line you're going to come across an Aboriginal. That's not bad. So I think that you've hit the nail on the head. There's a big issue there. It's got nothing to do with this constitutional issue. That's to do with governance. It's not about it. You don't need a change to the constitution to make that happen. That's about actually, good governance. Just very quickly, because I know we won't have a lot of time, no one could ever get to the bottom of why the federal government was paying for diesel for remote communities' power stations. And the best that we could come up with was that somewhere along the line, no one would pay. So therefore, it sort of just kept defaulting. And when we tried as a government, and I'm sure the current government has followed this through, so it's bipartisan, how do we actually get the appropriate level of government to do that and pay them compensation to do it? It was like pulling hen's teeth, because it's like too hard. So your issue, I don't think, has any connection directly with the constitutional change, although I agree with your first point about let's not water it down. But it's a very fundamental issue about how we actually don't just talk about headline dollars, but how they get there and who siphons them off in between and what else you can add into the equation to make it look good without getting an outcome.
Yeah, I'd just like to add a little quote that I heard at the Newcastle consultations about, and it was a quote from an elder who said that, you know, there are a whole range of problems, and you've pointed out one of the problems that, you know, needs to be solved. And he sort of talked about it in terms of managing expectations of what this constitution is going to do. And he said that we've got a long journey to walk, but at least we're going to be facing in the right direction. And I think that in terms of, you know, what we expect to gain out of this is really insightful in terms of, you know, we're still at the beginning of the road. We've still got a lot of little a lot of issues, big issues, and, you know, detailed issues like that that need to be ironed out, but at least we're tackling it from the right point of view, which is a positive point of view.
Thanks for the question. One just here.
My name's Peter. I'll try to keep this brief. I'm concerned at a general agreement amongst you that one of the first things that we need to do before we proceed with this is get broad, solid agreement amongst Aboriginal people about the content. I'm concerned that you're setting that up to fail. If we believe that there isn't going to be a Noel Pearson or a Warren Mundine or a Lewitra O'Donoghue, there will be, inevitably, and inevitably the media will dance on it, or at least large, negative, ugly sections of the media will dance on that disagreement. So I wonder if you're wedded to that, to the idea that we can get, and we should try to get, very broad, very solid Aboriginal agreement before we go to the rest of us, then are there ways in which we can preempt that horrible propensity that we have to forgive ourselves by saying they can't agree amongst themselves? Because we do it all the time.
Yes.
Look, I'd like to just jump in there and just say that for the record that Pat, Noel, Warren Mundine and Lowitja are all in support of the constitutional recognition, and we're having conversations with a lot of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander leaders with profiles and with national profiles and with local profiles, because they are incredibly influential. But, you know, one thing that they all do agree on, you know, and the conversation is varied, but they do say to us, but don't fail. You know, because they've got kids, they've got grandkids, they've got great-grandkids, and they know that there's too much at stake for this to fail. And, you know, without preempting what will happen in the future, the flavour of the conversation so far have been, you know, in support, really, of what we're trying to do here as a nation.
How do you shield against that, Melbourne?
Look, I don't think you do, but I think that if I can take you back to 1996 with the intervention, I was sure I was going to be
2006.
Thank you.
It's been 20 years.
It's a long, long time ago. Yeah, way back when. If you take that back, say 10 years before that, and exactly the same set of circumstances, I'm not asking anyone here to agree or disagree. I'm just trying to give you a point of time. 10 years earlier, there would have been literally protests in the street, there would have been marches, there would have been, you know, all the rest of it. I had a little bit of that, but not much. It was a sign that there is a change in the general populace and the way in which Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people also display and articulate their opinions, a bit like, you know, Coffs Harbour and marching on NAIDOC Day to celebration. That's a good thing. So I think that we are in a far more positive environment for people who would use it as an opportunity to push another barrow. That's your biggest issue, is that they're not against this, but boom, we'll go down here, we'll make a name of ourselves and we'll push it. I don't think we're in quite such an adversarial environment in that regard, so I think that we have a much greater chance. And I wasn't using those names earlier, honestly, for any reason at all, other than it's a reality that the media will have to. If someone like Noel, with his personality, was to come out, you have to focus on him, David.
Sure.
You have
really,
to hear his
for
opinion.
For a referendum to be successful, and what was amazing about the condition of 1967 was that every CWA, every group within every town in Australia was mobilised to say yes. It was a grassroots movement that actually can't be derailed by any one voice. It's a movement. It's such a momentum of people, and that's really what it takes to get it across the line. Yeah. And that's what it's going to take for us.
And will the bipartisanship on this hold, do you think, regardless of what the final wording ends up being?
I think so, because I think, you know, I think the intent of the political spectrum is good. I think,
because we hear a lot, Mal Brough, about Tony Abbott being Mr. No, opposing everything, negative, negative.
Don't listen to what the media has to say.
Actually, he could latch on to this as a real... He could be the face of the yes campaign.
I was about to say, is this something he will support to the hilt?
I don't know. But look, you know, I don't think anyone that knows Tony would say anything less than he is a passionate, committed individual in Indigenous affairs and lives it. You know, so that's a statement that cannot be rebuked. I mean, has lived in community and worked in them. Does it mean that he will support the ultimate goal? I can't speak to Tony.
Is his position?
He does agree in principle.
Yeah, but is he supporting preamble? Is that as did John Howard?
Look, I think that it'd be wise for them to actually just wait and see with all of the conversations that come out of it, because in fact, you know, what's come out of the national conversation is that a preambular statement could actually have more legal effect because it's at the beginning of the Constitution. It could have more effect on the whole Constitution legally than a statement within the body of the Constitution. So, interestingly enough, what people thought, a preambular statement is the minimum, actually could end up having more legal effect. So I think it would be wise for all of us to just take a step back and get engaged in this conversation to learn more about it, because I can tell you, I've learnt a lot, and, you know, it's most unwise to go in with, preconceived ideas.
Yeah. Let's get another question from the floor. We've got one over here. We've got a few to get through. Let's keep them quick, because we've probably only got 10 minutes. I don't mean the questions. You go for it. But we'll try and speed things up at this end.
Gotcha.
This is for Mal. You said that you talked about how, in hindsight, some of the interventions weren't correct, weren't right. And at the time of those interventions, my friends and I were talking about how we felt there were some human rights abuses with those, and if they were white Australians, and they wouldn't, the powers that be wouldn't have dared to impose them. What do you think about that?
Sorry, your name?
Julie.
Thanks, Julie. Julie, the human rights abuses happened today. The human rights abuses happened then, and the human rights that I took away were nothing in comparison to the deprivation that children had to live with every day. If I had to do it again, I would. The only reason I had to was because a popularly elected government of our people decided that these children didn't count as much as other children. If they were white kids, they would never have been in that position, because society would never have allowed it. So there's two sides to that coin.
Thank you. All right, we've got one at the back.
Yeah, hi, my name is Alicia Hodges. I just have a comment for the expert panel. But before I give the comment, I'd just like to acknowledge Johnny Agnes and the Ngunnawal people on whose land we walk on today. And my comment is around when I thought about this week with NAIDOC and the theme of change and the next step is ours. I thought about, well, what does that mean to me, and how does that impact on me as an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander person? But also our predecessors of those leaders that were in the past, and what does that mean to me as a young person and being a leader in my community? And I thought about the people of William Ferguson and Les Patton, who were champions, our leaders, in the 1920s. And then I was thinking about the conversations around the next step is ours, which is the second part around change. And the importance of the Constitution for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people is really about what we share in our communities, and that's families, individuals, and having those conversations, particularly around the kinship structures, who we are, where we're from, who else, who is our mob, where do we fit? And these are the conversations that we have every day, particularly in the workplace. That's where they mainly start. We talk about our families, talk about who we are. Sometimes it's a bit of an overshare and sometimes it's not. But that's where we as individuals come together as Australians, and we celebrate who we are when we sing our national anthem and when we look at our flags, the Aboriginal flag, the Torres Strait Islander flag, and the Australian flag. And what does that mean to us? So the question that I will ask is, when we think about the Constitution, think about what impact that has for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples when we think about our flags and who we are. Thank you.
Well, was there a question in there? I mean, that was a beautiful statement. I think we'll all agree. But was it a question about the flag in particular? Were you suggesting that that is something that should also be debated?
It was mainly just around the consideration about when we're thinking about so what, and if and if Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people should be included in the Constitution. When we look at our flags, it's not just a flag. It's about our identities. It's who we are and how we connect to this beautiful country of Australia.
Okay.
And that's really around what we need to be thinking about when we have these conversations. The questions will always be there. It's listening to those answers and being leaders in our community. Thanks.
Thank you. Does anyone want to respond to that? We'll move on.
I just think it's a beautiful statement, and it just echoes the fact that it's everyone's right. Every human's right to feel a sense of belonging and to know their own story and to have their story heard. And, you know, in government speak, that means social inclusion, you know. And I think that I absolutely agree with that, that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, for the first time, you know, have a right to have their story heard and have a right to feel a sense of belonging in their own country, and also have the right to a job. And I think that we don't have to look at all three of those things in isolation. I think all three of those things can be looked at together, and the glue is culture.
All right, let's get one here if we can.
Yeah, good evening. I've travelled 4,000 kilometres from the Kimberley. My name is Anne Polina. I'm a traditional owner. I'm also a scientist and an academic. And what I want to say is that I don't know if fellow Australians sitting here tonight are aware that in the Kimberleys, in NAIDOC week, this week, we've got riot police on country, abusing, locking up old people, traditional owners, and other community people. So my question is not so much to the panel. My question is to fellow Australians, is that I think I'm a little bit over having to redefine myself. What I'm saying is that I want to challenge fellow Australians about how do you redefine yourself in modernity? How do you redefine yourself in the context of what we're talking about here today? Because I truly believe that unless you can engage with Aboriginal people, unless you can engage with the cultural landscape, you cannot be truly Australian. So in 2011, my people are back in country, are being locked up, they're being abused by riot police. In NAIDOC week, I have come with a petition for the parliament, for the politicians, to say that it's time to slow down, it's time to appreciate what we've got as a nation. And so my challenge and my question is to fellow Australians sitting here is that this is no longer a black and white issue. This is a human issue. And so my challenge is to you, is how do you redefine yourselves as Australian? Because it doesn't matter about constitutional reform. The laws and legislation in this country remains the fact that colonisation is not over. The instruments of oppression are in all the laws. So what my appeal to you is to seriously consider, how do you see yourself as an Australian in modernity? Thank you.
Well, thank you for that contribution too. We've got time, I think, for perhaps one more question. I think I know there's a lot of hands up, but there's one very eager gentleman up the back. Let's go up there. You're on.
It's on, isn't it? Okay. I'd like to direct this question to Garth. Garth, like you mentioned before, about Cook's instructions. Now, because of Cook's deliberate disobedience of his orders, invalid, couldn't you say the claiming of the east coast of Australia, if we can go retrospectively back and give it retroactive effect in legal terms, was invalid? And because of that invalidity, states became, colonies became states, states then formed the Commonwealth. Now, because informed consent has never been given by Aboriginal people of the land, can it regarded contemporarily as illegal occupation. And any state or human condition Aboriginal people are in this country can amount to universal illegalities, such as the Genocide Convention and illegal occupation. Now, these are universal crimes. So, therefore, if we're going to talk about constitutional recognition, we've got to talk about the validity of the Commonwealth first. Thank you. Yeah.
I think the lack of consent at the origins of the colonisation of the eastern part of Australia was a historical issue. I can't find any basis in modern times for making it a basis for invalidity, but it does raise the question of the legitimacy of what was done and the illegitimacy of what was done, and that needs to be at least acknowledged. I think that's about the best we can try to achieve, but it's at least certainly worth trying to achieve that now. It was long before the Genocide Convention was even in force, let alone that it applied retrospectively. But I think to acknowledge the need for consent and the need for recognising the traditional rights in Australia then and continuing to the present day is critical. It's one of the most critical things we can hope to try to achieve to move a step towards reconciliation.
We will have to wrap things up there. I know some of you still had questions you wanted to ask, and I apologise, we haven't had time to get to them. But look, do make sure that all of you register on the National Museum website and take part in the online poll in this question. I think it's been a very interesting last, nearly 2 hours covering this topic, and I think we have established from all of our expert panellists here a better understanding of why this needs to happen, what it needs to involve, particularly the consultation and the importance of that,
yes.
And then also how we go about posing a question in what context and perhaps what context it shouldn't be posed as well. So perhaps this has, in a small way, progressed the issue a little, and I know the expert panel will continue doing great work around the country in progressing this too. But look, thank you all for coming as well. It's been wonderful having you here and some great questions tonight, and the fact that you are here I think does show just how genuine the interest is in this significant national issue. But please do thank our panellists, Mal Brough, Garth Nettheim and Alison Page. And also, I should point out, the next platform conversation, this has been the inaugural one. I hope it's been a success and the start of a great new format here at the National Museum. The next one will be this time next week, Friday the 15th of July at 6 o'clock, right here. Peter Singer and Jenny Brockie will be along. You will have to register. You'll have to book to get a seat here as well. So you might want to get onto that as soon as you can. But look, thanks again for coming tonight.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.